Hi folks, welcome to episode 113 of the Epochs of the Lotus Eaters. I'm joined by Bo, and today we're going to be talking about a meddlesome priest. I don't actually know much about Thomas Becket. I just know that he was a real pain in Henry II's arse, to the point where it was like, look, just someone deal with him. And then, spoiler alert, he gets his head cut up by four knights who are like, yeah, we have swords. Our king wants us to deal with this guy. Well, it looks like a nail, you know? So that's about all I know. I just know, you know, the very basic surface knowledge of Thomas Becket. But he was quite a towering figure in his day, wasn't he?
Yeah, I would say his murder is one of the most infamous murders in the Middle Ages. One of the most famous murders in English history.
And the more I learn about Thomas Becket, the more I think, well...
well, I'll try.
He seems like a real pain in the rear.
I'll tell the story and see what people think. Both the parties, i.e. Henry II and Becket himself, seems to have been at fault at various points and got stubborn about it.
Yeah.
But I'll tell the story and see what people out there make of it.
Okay.
I haven't really got strong feelings one way or another. Hmm. I think both are sort of to blame at certain points. But yeah, I mean, just to try and set the tone here, I mean, he was a nobody, really. His father was sort of a middling merchant type,
right?
From London. He was born in London, and his parents, they had some money. They had more than one house, but that was it. They were lowborn. I mean, their surname was Becket. And he goes on to be the second most powerful man in the country after the king, easily. I mean, he goes on to be an archbishop, you know, one of the princes of the church. Goes on to, you know, converse with kings and popes. He goes on to be a saint. He goes on to have a cult about him.
Any Americans watching might want to wonder what was class mobility like in feudal England. Turns out it was possible.
Yeah, at different points, actually. People have said, because all this takes place in the 12th century, people said that the 12th century, the 10th, 11th and 12th century, were more sort of fluid class mobility than in later centuries to some degree.
This might be true.
So, for example, there was a figure, Roger of Salisbury, 50 years before this, under the reign of Henry I, who had a similar sort of story. He was kind of a nobody, and he rose to be sort of Chancellor of England, sort of one of the most powerful men in the country. So, like, in the 14th or 15th century, that wouldn't have happened as much. But then I suppose there are examples like Thomas Cromwell, not Oliver Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell under the age of Henry VIII. He was sort of fairly famously, essentially a nobody.
Yeah.
So it was possible.
You had to be a man of outstanding talents.
Well, that's the thing. That's why Thomas Becket, I think, is a fascinating character. Where we've done a few people around Henry II now.
Yeah.
Haven't we? We've done Eleanor of Aquitaine, and we've done William Marshall. I thought we'd do the story of Becket because it's not just a story of a king and his troublesome, meddlesome priest. That's a wrong quote. I'll talk about that in later.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It's also a story to some degree about church and state, about the nature of government,
about
the nature of the king's relationship with the church.
Yeah, and ancient foreshadowing of Brexit.
And Rome. Could say something like that.
I'm just joking.
If you insist.
But I don't think it's that unrealistic, actually. But, well, it's not. It's the same impulse, right?
Yeah.
That governs about, it.
Yeah.
But I'll let you correct me later.
Well, one thing to say is that it's not all that uncommon for Archbishops of Canterbury to come to a sticky end. It's quite a few that have, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. William Laud, in the age of Charles I and Cromwell, or 1645, 17th century, he was executed. Thomas Cranmer, one of Henry VIII's archbishops, he had his head lopped off in the Tower. Simon Sudbury, during the age of the Peasants Revolt. He had his head cut off by peasants, just by peasants, a mob with a bread knife. They got him. And there's actually quite a few, even from long before the Norman invasion. So we've had archbishops of Canterbury since...
I'm not making any comment because I genuinely loathe the current archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
So
I
don't want to make any comment on that.
Yeah, no direct references to what may or may not happen in our time. But yeah, the idea that the Archbishop of Canterbury might come to a sticky end.
It has precedent.
But this is sort of quite a shocking murder, really. Mm. So to say that, you've already done the spoiler alert, although anyone that's ever heard of Becket knows.
It was only 800 years ago, and he's only famous for being murdered by Henry. Mm. So, I mean, I felt it wasn't too much of a spoiler.
No. And it's a really brutal one as well. Yeah. Like, you know, like Thomas Cranmer was put on trial by the state and sort of formally, sort of legally executed. Mm. This is just like a...
It's like a hit squad.
Yeah.
It's literally like a royal hit squad. A couple of knights go out there and just chop them up.
A murder most horrid. Yeah, certainly. Okay. So just talk, if I can quickly, talk a little bit about Henry II.
Yep.
That he, where we've discussed before the monarchy, and that when the Norman invasion happened, there was an old prophecy from the Confessor that that England would never be, that the green tree of England, as a metaphor, would never be won again until certain lineages were put back on the throne.
Right.
And you can sort of say that with Henry II, or people did, that the various parts of the split trunk, the tree of England, they were sort of rejoined, brought back together by Henry II. And he had sort of a fairly... really quite amazing lineage. You know, on his mother's side, he's the great grandson of William the Conqueror. Mm. You know, his mother was the Empress Matilda, who was the granddaughter of William the Conqueror, daughter of Henry I. And on his father's side, they're sort of the Counts of Anjou. It was his father, Geoffrey of Anjou, who had the nickname Plantagenet. So in all sorts of ways, even though he's not the son of a king, because that was one of the things some people could level against him in his life. So you've might got this great empire that much later was called the Angevin Empire, not during its time was it called the Angevin Empire, that stretches from, you know, Stirling at its most extreme extent. He conquered big chunks of Ireland and all the way down through Aquitaine by marriage, all the way down to the Pyrenees. Yeah. But he wasn't the son of a king, though. But nor was Charlemagne.
A lot of great men weren't.
Right. But he was a little bit, people have said, some historians have said, it's a bit of armchair psychology, he was a little bit insecure in his power, despite how massive it was.
Because
we might call it an empire, but it was very, very loose. It's not really right to call it an empire. They're very, very loose things.
Yeah, I mean, especially in a feudal domain, it's much more nuanced than an empire, frankly. Mm. You know, this is one of the critiques that Western political philosophers would level against the Turks. They genuinely had an empire where the entire thing was centralized in the Sultan, and the Sultan would put satraps, or whatever they called them, in various areas, and they were completely beholden to him, and the entire army was beholden to the Sultan. So this takes on the aspect of a proper empire, and they called that a tyranny because it looked tyrannical. Whereas in feudal Europe, it was very much a patchwork of local loyalties bound up by feudal oaths, religious oaths, to ultimately the king at the top. And so Henry has claim to lots and lots of obligation from these people, but they could at any time say, you know, I'm breaking this oath for whatever reason, and I have my own men, I have my own army, I have my own money, and now it's a big war, literally the right of feud. So to call it an empire, it's not accurate, but you see what people are trying to say. It's saying political influence. There's a kind of political faction, you know.
Yeah, but you know, like the lords of the border countries or in lowland Scotland and the magnates of the Aquitaine, it's not like they all see Rem or London as like the capital of their empire. It wasn't like that.
And exercising authority over like these people was probably a massive nightmare, to be honest. You know,
it was. Yeah. It definitely was.
Yeah, because a lot of things couldn't just be done by like fiat. you know, it'd have to have been done by persuasion. And so, anyway, not a proper empire.
So where Henry II was born to be a Count of Anjou, and then through his mother, claims England, fights for it, wins it, marries Eleanor of Aquitaine. Then on top of that, he's quite successful in war in the early part of his life as well. Gets a bit lucky. At different points in time, it's more or less easy to win victories, right? For example, maybe Alexander had a relatively easy go of it just when he was born. Maybe the original Muslim invasion spreading out from Arabia had a relatively easy time of it because the world was at a weak ebb.
Well, we know that they definitely did.
Right. Seems like Henry II benefited from that. So he sort of invaded Brittany, invaded big parts of Wales. Like I say, there was loads of unrest around Leinster in Ireland. He was able to sort of effectively take advantage of it. Where the Scots had come all the way down into northern England, they were sort of at a weak ebb, and he was able to take advantage of that. So he's born at the right time, the right place, like massively. And so it looked like, well, it was the case that he was sort of born to have this sort of amazing run of luck in all sorts of ways.
Because one thing about Henry, I never viewed him as any kind of genius in this regard, right? I mean, you know, he wins victories, but they're not spectacular victories. You know, they're not like, you know, Hannibal or Alexander or Napoleon. He's born at a good time and place, and he's capable of the job. He's sufficient for the job, but, you know, he's not one of these men who's setting the world on fire, in my view.
I see what you're saying. Yeah. He never went on crusade, old Henry II. He never launched a giant war against Frederick Barbarossa, the other most powerful man in Europe. The two most powerful men in Europe easily are Henry Plantagenet, Henry II, and Frederick Barbarossa, the Holy Roman Emperor, or the guy that is sort of, there's no such thing as Germany, but there's loads and loads of German states, and he sort of controls a lot of that.
He's the emperor of it.
Yeah. And there's an anti-pope at this point. There's the Pope, Alexander III, but there are anti-popes. Victor IV.
In France
things.
Or something.
Well, in Frederick Barbarossa's land. Barbarossa doesn't like Alexander III. So the Pope, Alexander III, this will come up in a bit later.
Yeah.
And Frederick Barbarossa are absolutely at odds with each other. Frederick Barbarossa's like, no, I don't like you, Alexander III. I picked this other guy. He's the real Pope now. And Rome is sort of like, well, wait, we don't accept that. Are we going to have another schism, a schism within a schism now? Because the great schism between East and West had already happened.
Yeah. The schism's all the way down.
Yeah, we're just going to keep schisming here. So, let's start on Thomas Becket's life.
Yes.
Because what Henry II wanted is someone to be his chancellor and his archbishop who he could just completely control, who would just absolutely be his puppet, be his man. That's what he's after. And so he hopes he'll get it in Becket.
Why don't I hire a commoner for the job?
Yeah.
He'll surely not have loads of connections and be a real pain in my rear.
Not have the sort of chutzpah to go his own way, be his own man.
So just the thing, like you could, class differentials are important in this era. And you can see how Henry, who his whole life is born to rule and knows he's going to rule, you know, even if he's not directly the son of a king, I mean, you can't have the level of aristocratic lineage that he has and not expect to rule something. And Thomas Becket, a plebeian, a peasant, just, you know, whose father does peasant things. There's no question. There's no contest. You're Henry. You don't even think about it. You think, well, obviously.
Yeah.
He's a peasant.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally have thousands of knights. I literally have a giant empire that stretches the length of Europe. What do you want? Yeah.
Just to try and set the tone on how sort of low-born Becket was. He was low-born, absolutely, in terms of just sort of blood.
Yeah.
Like how blue-blooded he was. But his family had some money. They weren't poor.
Yeah.
They weren't peasants. Like I say, his father was a merchant to the point where they had more than one home, but not much more than that. He wasn't fabulously rich.
Yeah.
But he was rich enough, and he was their only son, to send him to sort of quite a good school. Even then they had sort of kind of the equivalent of a grammar school, or they were all sort of church schools. Back then in the 12th century, nearly all education was just church education. That's just the way it was.
Yeah.
So they had just enough money, just to cut ahead slightly, a few years ahead, to give you an idea of maybe their station, the Becketts. His father sort of comes upon hard times.
Hmm.
There's a fire in London, not the Great Fire of London. There's been quite a few fires in London. And Becket's father's houses, I think even his warehouses burned down. He sort of loses nearly all his money. And he has to go to work for another big merchant house in London.
Right.
So they were kind of rich-ish, but not completely independently wealthy.
What we call middle class now, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it's a complete anachronism, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah, something like that. Something
that's
like
why I say what we would call now.
Yeah.
They didn't have that something then. Like but that. But it does go to show you that, I argue with Americans, Adam and Sitch, a lot about feudalism in Europe, and especially in England, because they don't seem to understand that the peasants were free, as in they were free to gather their own wealth, to maintain their own property, and to enlarge their own possessions. And Thomas Becket's father is a good example of that.
Yeah, I mean, it would depend exactly where and when
sure.
you're saying that. So sort of after the Black Death, which is way after this, because the Black Death in Britain is 1348 to 49, when a lot of serfdom is done away with at that point. But still, they weren't slaves.
And that's, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. The Americans just can't understand. Well, how does a medieval peasant earn money? Well, however he likes, a lot of the time your options will be limited, so it'll be practical to work on the land, or it'll be practical to be a merchant or something, but you can do well out of these things. You can make money. You can buy two homes, you can send your children to private schools. It doesn't mean that you're just eating dirt all the time. It's it's a lot more complicated.
I don't know why you argue with Adam and Sitch.
I like Adam and Sitch. They're just American liberals.
Yeah, unlettered.
That's fair. Unlettered is fair. But they are.
Could I be more condescending? Unread.
On these subjects, there that is true.
Okay, so Becket's early life then, he does go to quite a good school. And from there, though, he does have to work.
Mm.
They're not independently wealthy. And it seems that, what he eventually gets at some point, he works for one of the big merchant houses, one of the big guilds in London. He eventually gets a position when he's in his sort of mid-20s in the household, of the Archbishop of Canterbury, a Theobald.
Hmm.
And now we don't have a fantastic amount of detail that a modern historian would really like about how the next few years happen. But all you can infer, we can certainly infer, that he's just really capable, really charismatic, because Theobald quite quickly raises him very high, starts giving him positions within the ecclesiastical hierarchy, starts making him sort of under deacons of various churches around the place, starts giving him administration roles, sends him on an embassy to Rome.
I can't help but feel that when you're surrounded by people who often are not educated and may not be the smartest tools in the box, then when you get this well-educated, quite bright chap come along, he's like, yeah, I can do that. Brilliant. That, and that. I need all this done. I can completely see how this would unlock doors, open doors for Thomas Becket.
I think it's fair to describe him as a fixer.
Mm.
You've got a task. Mm. You've got a project. You need a capable project manager.
Yeah.
Oh, him. He gets things done.
Yeah.
He just gets things done.
Oh, he's smart, educated, literate.
That will take you a long way in life, and always has.
Yeah.
Right?
But especially now, when more than half the population has been to university, it's less of an important thing. But back then, this guy's pretty unique.
Just before he sort of starts doing that sort of thing, like going on an embassy to Rome on behalf of the Archbishop of Canterbury, must say, Theobald even sends him to Paris to do some more learning, some more book learning. He goes to Bologna at one point, I believe, to the university there.
Mm.
And he's often described as worldly and not a great scholar, although he was scholarly on some level. He was certainly educated, obviously completely literate, but he wasn't sort of a great Latinist.
Mm.
He wasn't considered, one of the leading lights of scholasticism or anything.
No, no.
So, like, later, there were lots of letters that survive.
Hmm.
And historians look back and they say, Beckett must have dictated that. He wasn't that good a writer.
Hmm.
However, you couldn't say he was stupid. You couldn't say he was uneducated or anything like that.
Yeah.
So it seems through the next few years, he is sort of a fairly meteoric rise, because by the time he's in his early 30s, he holds lots and lots and lots of offices in the state. He's sort of, he's one of the most important people in the structure of power at Canterbury. He's like one of the deacons of Canterbury, which is very, very powerful. And a man in his sort of early 30s, mid 30s, it just speaks of he's been singled out.
And I think it's important to emphasize the power of the church at this time as well. Because when we say deacon, people think, oh, it's just some guy in a robe who has no claim on me whatsoever. That certainly was not the case in 12th century England. The church was a massive, powerful institution that was responsible for, like you said, education, but it was also responsible for alms, for feeding the poor, for the destitute. You know, in all matters spiritual, the church was the authority, and people viewed religion in the same way that we view science. And so people would take the dictates of the priests to be the same way that we take it on faith that the planets around and they circle around the sun, and and gravity operates and electrons and all these things. They view religion in exactly the same way. And so this gives the church the sort of power that science has now, you know? So honestly, moderns just do not understand the influence that the church wielded in the ancient world, because it just doesn't in the modern world.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very good point. They barely had a state as we know it.
Mm.
Most of the machinery of the state, if you can't really call it that, but it's
very primitive.
Yeah, and lots and lots of it is based around the church and ecclesiastical sort of frameworks.
Mm.
You know, like the See of Canterbury or the See of York.
Mm.
They're sort of they're a legal and spiritual authority.
Mm.
The main one, other than the crown itself.
Yeah. And of these things are underpinned by God Almighty.
Of course there's no sort of welfare state or anything like that. There's no, like, police.
No.
Right?
No.
There's hardly anything, really. But, like, all education, there's not really any hospitals as we know them.
No. Again, anything all of like this that, is done
it's
by
all,
the church.
It's all done by the church.
Yeah.
It's all done by the church.
It's such an important social and political institution that to say Thomas Becket has risen from nothing to become a deacon of Canterbury,
it's impressive, right?
Yeah.
It says he had a character, an amazing character.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of a modern... It's like him being like the president of like Oxford University or something, you know, the modern era. You know, this he's come out of nowhere. He's in his early 30s and he's in charge of one of the most prestigious institutions in the entire country, you know, recognized across Christendom, you know. And so it's no small thing is what we're trying to emphasize here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it just says that he is capable on all sorts of levels.
Mm.
And anyway, the king... It catches the king's eye at some point.
Just a quick thing. I think, just a thing, where you say he's a fixer, I think that's a great, that's been lingering in my mind since you said it. Because it's a great way of putting it. Because as you say, he's not necessarily innovating on doctrine or, you know, like you say, he's not a scholar necessarily, although obviously he's literate. But there are these kinds of men all throughout history and even, you know, all throughout the modern era, where you just rely on them to get things done. And he's clearly... like getting a lot of things done for a lot of people and pulling in a lot of threads to himself. You know, he's becoming a nexus, where people are relying on him. And that's a very powerful thing to accrue.
Yeah. And he's not, as I mentioned, he's not just one of the deacons at Canterbury.
Mm.
He's got power over loads and loads of different smaller church estates and things all over the country.
And he's going to have a huge level of fame. At this point, fame again is something in the modern era we don't really understand from what it was like in previous eras. Because actually, most people weren't famous. Even the people who were important weren't famous. Mm. And you actually would know someone by their rank rather than their name. But Thomas Becket may well have had a name that preceded him, right? Mm. As in, like, you would know the King of Hungary or something. You wouldn't necessarily know the name of the King of Hungary. But and so, you know, you wouldn't know who the deacon of the next church was, you know, two counties over. You wouldn't know these things, you know. And so it's just, you know, Thomas Becket, the fact that his name has come down to us so far shows that, he's an important man and probably had a level of, notoriety, maybe we'll call it. I don't know.
But, well, by the end,
he's... Yeah.
Like, his memory, the cult of St. Thomas, is, like, in Spain, it's in Sicily. He was... Canterbury became arguably the third or fourth most important point of pilgrimage in Western Europe. Or no, in all of Christendom. Mm. There was not... Canterbury Cathedral hadn't really been a prominent place for pilgrims to go to until after the murder and canonization of Becket.
Yeah.
And then it went... The Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, St. Peter's in Rome, and then either... Santiago de Compostela or Canterbury.
Yeah.
It became that important. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miracles were said to have happened.
Oh, wow.
Because of St. Thomas.
far be it for me to question that.
So, yeah, right. So his name went far and wide in the end, absolutely. But already, would have had some sort of name recognition.
So that, and again, just in the medieval era, that's a strange thing. Most people didn't have a name recognition. You know, the number of celebrities that people know now is way, way higher than what we would call celebrities in this time and place. So it's just, again, very different world is what I'm trying to emphasize.
By the 1150s, he catches the king's eye. Mm. Henry himself sees him, and Theobald, the old archbishop, impresses upon the king that he's really good at his job.
Mm.
He might not be the greatest Latinist.
Sure.
But, say, he's a fixer. And Henry just likes the cut of his jib. Anyway, makes him chancellor.
No small thing.
Well, in a secular sense, you're pretty much the most powerful man in the country, other than the king.
You essentially control, like, the finances, right?
You're a clerk of the king, but just the first one.
Yeah.
It's something like a prime minister. Again, that's a complete anachronism and wrong in all sorts of ways.
But,
and a real historian would scoff and roll their eyes at that. But
you sure do. But it's proportionally,
like
the sort of power that you're wielding, that's, you know, you're the sort of first interface to the mechanisms of government that the king has.
Mm.
And so it is kind of like a prime minister. I don't know how, you know, I don't think that's an unfair comparison.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah.
Yeah. So... And he's still only sort of, in his mid-30s at this point. So sort of a meteoric rise.
Must have a great career ahead of him.
Now,
smooth sailing from this point onwards.
Yeah, there's no downtick from here, surely. But he is very, very rich.
Hmm.
He sort of almost can't help but become very, very rich. Now, quick point just to talk about his relationship, his sort of personal relationship with Henry.
Hmm.
A lot of historians play this up quite a lot. Modern scholars sort of put a bit of cold water on this, that they were best friends. They were absolutely best friends. The sort of slightly older version is that they really were.
Hmm.
It seems that they certainly spend loads of time in each other's company, playing cards, playing chess, going horse riding, doing hunting. And
it strikes me they probably had quite a strong friendship then.
Yeah, definitely.
Because why would you spend all of your time? Why would you promote this one guy? Why would you spend all of your time with him if you weren't really friendly with him?
Well, the cold water that has been poured on it is simply that the two men thought about it differently. So from Thomas's point of view, they were just best friends and that's the end of the story. But from Henry's point of view, he was like, yeah, I do like spending time with him and all that sort of thing. We are friends, but still, he's just one of my minions, though, still. The reason why modern scholars say that is because there's quite a lot of examples of him taking the mickey out of Becket, humiliating him a bit. So, for example, there's one story where Becket was wearing a very, very fine robe.
Yeah.
And Henry jokes with him, takes the mickey out of him, and then says, actually, take that off and give it to someone else, give it to a peasant.
Oof.
Like, calm down, mate. basically like that. There's quite a lot of examples of that.
Right.
Where, because there's the other thing to mention about Beckett, by this point anyway in his life, he loved show. He loved ostentation. He loved wearing, he loved changing clothes multiple times a day, wearing golden things, jewel encrusted things.
The thing is, from Henry's perspective, you can kind of see where this is coming from, right? He's like, you know, take that off. You're embarrassing. You're clearly not born to the purple. You know, I realize that at some point you probably had to wear quite plain clothes. And I realize that you're compensating for that now, but it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
You know, you're showing that you're not one, you know, you're not one of this class.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.